In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If you remember from your fifth grade science, you know all about the life cycle of water. Water evaporates from the oceans and lakes, which rains on the land, and which makes its way back to the ocean, where it evaporates once again and repeats the cycle. But if you're a longtime listener of iSpy Radio, you also know about the green funding cycle. Democrats get elected, which rain taxpayer dollars down on activist green groups, which finds its way back to Democrat campaigns, who get elected and repeat the cycle. That hub of activist green groups is the key in that green funding cycle. It's a veritable hive of nonprofit organizations and think tanks and activist groups. They get that money and then hire marketers and lobbyists and organizers and professional social media trolls. They hire and train activists. They form political action committees to donate to Democrat campaigns and causes and spread their free taxpayer billions to other left-wing organizations. And then all of those trained activists and marketers go to work for Democrat campaigns when elections roll around. And together, they all push leftist agendas from socialism to nationalized healthcare and then amplify anything Democrats and the leftist media say to make it look like it's more important to people than it actually is. That the leftist way of thinking is somehow the national way of thinking. In 2014 alone, the Obama White House spent $22.2 billion on climate change. How much of that went to Republican organizations or businesses, do you think? Imagine what the Tea Party could have done with $22.2 billion. And that was just 1 year of funding for the left. Tens of billions of global warming dollars is spent every year. But now, forget tens of billions, now Biden wants to borrow and spend trillions of dollars on climate change and green energy. Imagine the impact of handing Democrats 1,000 times more money than they're already getting from the government. And that's not even the end of it. With Biden resuscitating Obamacare, Democrats are looking to take over the healthcare industry entirely, which is one-sixth of our $22 trillion economy. All of this as Trump was just beginning to expose and turn down the taxpayer money spigot funding the left. His last budget proposal in 2020 wanted to cut billions of dollars of spending, including a 26% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. He wanted to end the deficit spending by 2035, and the way to get there was to cut out the borrowing, which is what allows the government to spend all that money on the left's funding cycle. Now, if you were the global left, if there were literally trillions of dollars at stake, what would you be willing to do to get that money? Commit voter fraud? Rig Wall Street trading? Destroy the economy? Create a worldwide panic over a disease that has a 999-in-1,000 survival rate? We all know people are willing to do all sorts of shady things for $1 million. Imagine how fast the ethics would fly out the window for $100 trillion. Keep that in mind as we talk today. I'd like to welcome Chuck Weiss back to the show. He is a former meteorologist and trained scientist and believer in actual science, not politicized science. And that's why we love to have him on when we get into these kinds of discussions. Chuck, it's great to have you back on.
Glad to be here, Mark, and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, thanks, and same to you. So with the continued rollout of COVID vaccines and the miraculous rollback of COVID restrictions in Democrat states now that the political party in charge has changed, we're seeing more and more of the entirety of COVID was and is exactly what we thought from the beginning. COVID is a real disease, but the decisions around it are entirely political. And if you're using politics instead of science, that begs some deeper discussions on the ethics of it. Are you willing to let people die and kill an economy just for political gain? And how can you be trusted if you're willing to gamble with people's lives and livelihoods, not to mention their freedoms? So that'll be the basis for our discussion today. And I'd like to start with the troubling beginnings of COVID, the Wuhan lab and what was going on there. I don't think we've yet had the real truth as to how exactly it got out of the lab, whether it was on purpose or on accident. But something's come up recently that speaks directly to the ethics behind these dubious experimental research. And this is something that you had put us onto. That Steve Hilton of Fox News has been zeroing in on gain-of-function virus research. This was a research method that was actually stopped by President Obama because of the ethical problems around it. Help our listeners understand what that research is about and why Obama stopped it during his tenure.
Well, he stopped it, Mark, because they realized that the purpose of it was to make viruses, which are normally non-transmissible pathogens, the ones that they've seen, like with bat coronaviruses and these sorts of things. They've seen a lot of these viruses in the environment that are not transmissible and not really that much of a danger to humans by themselves, get converted to extremely dangerous pathogens by running them through different animal populations until the virus learns through its own mutations of doing that to be able to do what the COVID, the COVID-2 virus is now able to do. And so they knew that there was a big danger in this because you're taking pathogens that normally don't infect humans and you're making them able to do that. And it's unknown as to the serious health consequences and dangers of these things could actually pose to the public if you're going to cause them to mutate, genetically engineering them like this gain of function research does so that they can infect humans. And that's exactly what happened with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It was a takeoff of SARS-CoV-1 and research that was done in Wuhan about that, but it's pretty strong evidence, as Hilton pointed out in what he's been able to gather, and from other sources too, that this virus was created in a lab. It was done exactly through this gain of function type research that made it as dangerous as it became.
Yeah. And that's certainly what it's looking like. More and more of these reports are coming out pointing to this gain of research function type of research that was going on there in the Wuhan lab. And thanks to a cousin of my producer who's a retired vet, and he'd actually never heard of gain-of-function research, he put us on to a white paper from 2016 about the ethics concerning ethical concerns, I should say, involved in creating viral diseases like this gain-of-function. And as you can imagine, this kind of amplifying diseases to let's see what happens is hotly debated simply because it's so dangerous, especially in the wrong hands. It can be very devastating. Talk to us a little bit about Fauci's role from his work on this research.
Well, Anthony Fauci had a definite hand in what was going on in these labs in Wuhan, because after the Obama administration said, we're not going to allow any research labs in the United States to carry on this type of work because of the potential dangers. And these were experts he was getting opinions from that said, no, this is not a good idea to do. And the main concern was, if you're going to mutate viruses genetically by engineering them like this gain-of-function research does, that if anything escaped from a lab that was a potentially extremely dangerous pathogen, you could start a deadly pandemic that could kill millions of people and not be able to stop it. That was their main concern. So they said, no, we're not going to do that here. But Fauci and people that he works around apparently gave the middle finger to the U.S. officials who said, not on our watch, not here, and took the research offshore and went to China with it. And there were millions of dollars that was given to the Chinese government. The big question, though, is whether or not our government knew anything about this. I don't know. Steve Hilton didn't say that one way or the other, but he did say there were millions of dollars funded by somebody that went to China and went specifically to the Wuhan lab to continue this gain-of-function research. And the scientist that was in charge of it was the one who started genetically engineering SARS-CoV-1 that eventually emerged and got out of that lab as SARS-CoV-2. Mm-hmm. So the big question is, who's funding this? But Fauci knew a lot about it because he was involved in trying to understand SARS-CoV-1, which emerged in China back in 2005. And so he had a lot of, and his interest is in HIV and other retroviruses that cause autoimmune conditions.
Yes,
He had a big interest in studying this stuff because somehow he thought he could derive information from doing gain-of-function research that would enable him to either develop a vaccine for HIV or even for these types of viruses. So there was an immense interest in that. Bill Gates could be involved in it, too. I don't know. I just we can't connect all the dots at this point, but there's a lot of suspicion.
Yeah, there is. And in fact, I remember reading a report from a scientist early on in the whole COVID-19 scare, that it did look like there were some HIV markers in there. And he himself was a He was one of the ones that was initially leading a lot of the research in HIV back in the day. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Chuck Weiss talking about the ethics around all the COVID research. Coming up, what's in those vaccines and why, and are we all just guinea pigs? And welcome back. This is the Ice 5 Radio Show. We're talking today to Chuck Weiss. He's an advocate for actual science and the scientific method, not politicized scientific garbage that we've seen throughout the COVID scaredemic. And Chuck, we were talking there during the break, and because we were leaving that last segment there, talking about HIV, and it does look like there was some HIV proteins that have been inserted into this, into COVID-19. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the HIV protein in this virus is what others that have looked at it, in particular, Dr. Weiler, who is a microbiologist and also virologist, who's looked at this in close detail, said there is a spike protein, or a, not a spike protein, but a HIV protein in the virus that was placed in there through this genetic engineering. And the effect it has when you become infected with it is it has an ability to suppress your own initial immune response mm-hmm. to the virus. Mm-hmm. So by the time your body figures out, hey, I've been infected with this COVID-2, I need to mount a defense, the virus has got a head start in manufacturing and reproducing itself in your system, and you get a huge tidal reaction or big pushback by your own body against this virus when it finally figures out how to mount a defense.
Right.
And that's what causes the dangerous cytokine storms that causes the lung damage and to tissue in your lungs and other organs in your body when the virus really gets going. That's what makes it dangerous. If it didn't have that ability, it would be similar just to a lot of other coronaviruses that are found in nature that are really harmless except for giving you a cold or flu, this sort of thing. But that's a big difference between this genetically engineered virus and what we see in the natural environment. And it was lab created.
Yeah.
It was lab created.
And that's what I was talking about going on in that last segment there, was there was an HIV research scientist who said this is how you can tell that it was man-made rather than something that occurred naturally because of that HIV marker. He says that had to have been inserted in there. And he suspects it, well, and again, getting back to the gain of function, it would certainly fit with that type of non-ethical research, as far as I'm concerned, where they're trying to amplify that and make it more powerful. By inserting HIV into that, that would certainly do that.
Yes, exactly. And here's the other thing that goes into the ethics part of this whole thing. You know, our country did tell people like Fauci, we're not going to let you do that kind of research in the U.S. because of the dangers that it poses. So when Fauci and people like him take this sort of research and bring it over to the Wuhan lab in China, well, the Chinese communists don't let you do anything in their country without letting their own scientists sit side by side, or you know, whether it's that or whether it's business, and they want to see what you're doing and they want you to teach them how to do it so they can compete against you. And when you take this sort of research and bring it over to China, the communists' interest in this is not to help people, it's to kill people. The immediate interest in a communist in looking at something like this is to figure out a way to use it against the population that concerns it, that they can continue to subdue. So the communists like to be able to start bioweapons programs or things like this. And so to take medical research to a country like China and let their scientists learn what people like Fauci and people he worked with knew about these sorts of programs.
Yeah.
You're teaching them basically how to start bioweapons programs, and you know that eventually that's what they're going to do.
Sure.
They might have already done that with this virus. We don't know. But it's just ridiculously stupid to trust a country that is run by communists to give them this sort of technology and let them start monkeying with it in a lab to do whatever they feel like they want to do with it. And in the case of this, I'm sure the Chinese would like to use it as a bioweapon, where we didn't have any interest in that, at least initially.
Well, and to hand it over to a country that we already know has killed 60 million of its own people.
Exactly.
You're talking the ultimate level of control here. And it's so reflective of Marxist ideology, where you cause the problem and then you offer the solution to that problem. I mean, this is the ultimate expression of that, is that you have created a massive man-made disease that you then release into the general public, and now you come in with the solutions to that. I mean, it really begs the question, did China interfere in our elections along with China Joe? and the Democrats help to hide their involvement in all this, because we're certainly not going to get to it, get to the bottom of all of this under a Biden administration.
No, we're not. They're going to stop any investigations of this, just like they will upon themselves that the Trump administration was looking into. There was all sorts of corruption with Joe Biden, and it could very well have something to do with this. But even if it doesn't, the decision by these people like Anthony Fauci to let this research get into the hands of communist Chinese was just a horrible decision. I don't know what this guy was thinking. Yeah. And he hasn't been the brightest bulb on the block, and seems to be very politically motivated in how he wants to tell us we have to treat this disease. He was the guy who told us that hydroxychloroquine and these anti-inflammatory drugs like it don't work, when yet he knew they work when they treated SARS-CoV-1 over in China with, and he'd even recommended to Chinese doctors to use hydroxychloroquine for SARS-CoV-1.
Yeah,
and here he's telling us, no, it doesn't work. It's anecdotal.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about HCQ in the next segment, but getting back to ethics and the whole evil scientist aspects of all of this, we are essentially looking at a massive human experiment. We had learned that the COVID vaccines are unusual compared to previous vaccines. Unlike traditional vaccines that use a weakened form of a disease, which your body then learns to recognize and fight against, the two vaccines here in the U.S. both use mRNA. That's messenger RNA that essentially tricks your cells into producing protein similar to COVID-19. This is an entirely new vaccine technology that is instructing your DNA to trigger a response. And I know that you're personally opposed to that. I certainly am, because we don't know any of the long-term results of any of this. And in fact, if you look at their disclosure statements, they say that the initial study of this won't even be done until July of 2021. And the final study won't be done until 2023. So they are essentially admitting that, hey, we're using everybody as a guinea pig for this, because we don't know how it's going to happen.
Well, that was Dr. Weiler's concern when he wrote his paper about this, about their developing the mRNA vaccines, because he said he found that all but one of the proteins in the SARS-CoV-2 virus have what he calls unsafe epitopes, which are parts of proteins that are capable of causing immune conditions, autoimmune conditions, and immune responses against the proteins that are healthy in our own body. And he did a video on this in addition to his paper. So his concern is, when you inject this virus into your body, you're telling your own cells to manufacture the spike protein that surrounds the envelope of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But then you may have healthy protein sequences just like this that your the immune response that your body will develop to the shot won't recognize the difference of between healthy and unhealthy, and it'll start attacking your healthy DNA and certain strands of it as it's trying to do the same thing with the virus. And so if it can't differentiate, you can cause all kinds of problems with that. And we're actually seeing some of the people who have had this shot get some very serious reactions to it. And the one that really caught my eye was the doctor in Florida who had within a day or so after getting the shot, had his antibody defense to the shot start attacking blood platelets in his body, and it actually destroyed all of them. And by the time he got to the emergency room, he had zero blood platelets left in the analysis that they did.
Yes.
And he died 16 days later from a massive brain hemorrhage that was caused by the complete destruction of all the blood platelets in his blood serum.
Yeah.
And they know for a fact this was caused by that vaccine. It was too close, and things just don't happen like this to normally healthy people without the vaccine having a direct cause of what happened to you.
Right. And it is very frightening to think that we're deploying this widespread into society without any real knowledge of the long-term effects of this. I mean, we just vaccinated the frontline workers. What happens if there's some long-term consequences? We just don't know.
Right.
Yeah. So,
and
unfortunately, we do need to take a break there. Coming up, we'll be talking about HCQ and something to make Chuck's head explode. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Chuck Weiss. He's a trained scientist and believer in actual science, not politicized science. We've been talking about COVID and the ethics of the science and politics surrounding it. And Chuck, we've had you on before. And having spoken with you both on air and off air, I know that there are three letters that just drive you nuts, and that's HCQ. And this is something that is truly going to make your head explode. A friend of mine got his first vaccine shot recently, and he asked what was in it. And he was given a card and information about the ingredients and side effects for the Pfizer vaccine. And he said to the healthcare worker, those first couple ingredients sound a lot like hydroxychloroquine to me. I wonder if that's why hydroxychloroquine was held up as a treatment. We used to take it in Vietnam for malaria. And so the healthcare worker says, yeah, funny that was done. Our protocols had all of our staff members treated with hydroxychloroquine and a drug combination before the vaccine was available. So they're keeping it from the public, but they're giving it to these healthcare workers after saying it doesn't work.
Yeah,
does that
exactly.
Not, I mean, does that not just make your head explode?
Oh, my God. That is so outrageous. I mean, I've got the whole history of what they did to hydroxychloroquine and all of the things that they did since last spring to keep the public from ever taking this drug and actually blocking your doctor's own ability to prescribe it. There were several doctors last spring that knew how effective this was in combating COVID-19. The main thing it's able to do is it stop the cytokine storm, which is what makes the virus deadly. And if you can do that, you've won 99% of the battle. But a French doctor started using it's Didier Raoult, who from Marseille, France, was the first guy to publish a study last March 17th. That was March 17th, 2020, that showed how effective the use of HCQ was as long as you take it with zinc sulfate and Z-Pak. That was his treatment protocol. Mm-hmm. And then in the United States, a Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, who's a New York doctor, started using Raoult's prescription to treat his own patients who had COVID-19. And the same thing, very effective treatment. And all the people he gave the drug to had recovered very rapidly within a matter of a couple of days after taking the drug, where ones that don't get it got sick and some of them even died, you know, and had very severe symptoms. And then we've had more doctors, frontline doctors, like Dr. Simone Gold came out last summer with her conference that she had on the steps of the Capitol, saying this is the way to treat this disease. And no sooner did these people come out saying all this and had proof that it worked than we had the Lancet study come out, which is from a prestigious medical journal. And they claimed it doesn't work, and in fact, it can cause serious heart problems and a bunch of other things, and recommended against it. And that study that came out is what triggered Rick Bright from the FDA last April 5th, or June 15th, I should say, to revoke the emergency authorization the FDA gave to allow people to use this. And just prior to that, President Trump, allowed for there to be a manufacturing of 29 million doses in a stockpile because the research about hydroxychloroquine was also positive. But it was a Lancet study that killed it. And then Lancet came out after they managed to kill the emergency use authorization in the United States and said, oh, we're sorry. Our study was flawed. We didn't have the data that we said we had. And, you know how that ended up. But the point is, here's a phony study that came out from a prestigious medical journal that put the brakes on the use of these anti-inflammatories like hydroxychloroquine. And now, to this day, at least in the blue states, you cannot have a doctor prescribe this drug to treat the symptoms of COVID-19. Mm. It's outrageous. And now here they are coming out with the vaccines, and we are the guinea pigs to these things because several steps were missed along the way in the normal way that you have trials on whether or not these sorts of vaccines can be effective. And so we may find out, a year from now, this was a big mistake to release these vaccines because of all the potential health problems we may end up getting from them. And I'm not saying we will because I'm not an expert in that field, but I can sure point to the ones and the doctors who say that there is a potential problem with this and it's being ignored. Weilert said he tried to warn the vaccine manufacturers about these unsafe epitopes, and they ignored him. He has yet to get any response from them. They just went right ahead and manufactured it, and now they're giving this to the general public. And then we find out, like you said, my word, here are the people in the medical community that were taking this very same regimen of hydroxychloroquine to medical workers that they're telling the public is unsafe to use.
Yeah, it's just astonishing. It really is. You know, the whole response to COVID has never made any sense because if you're truly dealing with an unknown disease, it should have been an all-of-the-above approach. HCQ, vitamin D, A supplement, I mean, just on and on down the list of all the things that they should have been trying rather than forcing everybody into accepting this vaccine that is either going to tinker with your DNA or you can get the one from the UK eventually that uses human embryonic kidney cells. Exactly. Great. You know, that's a great choice there for people.
Oh, it's horrible. It's a horrible choice. You know, and now there's four anti-inflammatories that may work very effectively. There's not only hydroxychloroquine, now there's budesonide, dexamethasone, and ivermectin. All of those are considered to be successful treatment options to COVID-19. For example, if your body couldn't accept hydroxychloroquine, maybe you have an allergic response or something that wasn't good, there are three others you can try: budesonide, dexamethasone, or ivermectin. And the medical community is not talking about any of them. All they do is they've conditioned us to accept this vaccine, and the media continues to report to us there's no other successful treatment. You've got to get vaccinated, bottom line, or we're going to continue in this crisis. And that's complete nonsense based upon other doctors that have been using these other treatments and knowing that they work, only to have the media lie to you and say that they don't work or ignore them. It's kind of a combination of both.
Well, and then on top of that, just recently there was another article out that said that there was an Israeli researcher who came up with a nose spray that kills 99.9% of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. A simple nose spray, rather than spending billions and tens of billions of dollars on this, on these vaccines that are all experimental and turn everybody into a guinea pig. Here's a simple nose spray. In addition to HCQ, I mean, it seems like there's any number of ways that we could have combating this other than the way that we have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. These treatments should have been the ones that should have been going forward last spring. Like I said, when you go back to the initial doctors that had made these nice discoveries that things like hydroxychloroquine work very well and recommended widespread use of it to treat COVID-19 symptoms and to block the dangerous ones that can kill you, this is the reaction we got from the medical community. So it was all against it. And what this tells me is there is an enormous a profit motive behind all of this.
Yes,
because
the
manufacturers of these vaccines are going to be splitting basically a $2 trillion pie that's going to be paid for by you and me, the taxpayer.
Yep.
And the beauty of that is they have no liability for this. If something goes wrong with these vaccines or somebody dies from them, they have a liability shield offered by the government to where the general public, any part of it that gets affected in an adverse way, is not going to have any legal recourse at all.
Nope.
That's a win-win for the manufacturers of the vaccine.
Sure.
And I'm not saying I'm against them, Mark, because vaccines do work in a lot of cases. But this is one time where they have gone completely awry to how to really treat this this virus, and the politicalization of medicine in this regard has just been absolutely appalling. In my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same party that thinks nothing of killing babies in the womb is now saying, "Trust us as we mess around with your cells and trick them into producing virus-like proteins." What could possibly go wrong? Chuck, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been fun as always.
Yes, Mark, glad to be here and glad to help out.
And welcome back. Jonathan Williams is the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. He's also co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report by ALEC of competition among the states and a ranking of their economic outlook. Find out more, head to ALEC.org. That's A-L-E-C, ALEC.org. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, well, good to be back with you as always, and greetings out here from the land of make-believe in Washington, D.C.
Boy, make-believe now more than ever, that's for sure. So last time we talked, it was mid-February 2020, and President Trump had just released his budget proposal that looked to cut spending, ironically enough, by $4.6 trillion and provide a way to balance budget in 2035 if they stuck with it. Instead, we have just simply blown out the deficit, which is now higher than GDP. The national debt, I mean. On top of that, Biden wants to spend $100 trillion on the Green New Deal while slashing blue-collar jobs and raising taxes on the investing class. I mean, here's just the headline from a New Republic article from early December 2020. Why Joe Biden can stop worrying and start spending like crazy. And the rest of the article reads exactly how you would expect with a headline like that. Has all reason and common sense now gone out the window?
Well, basically, right? I mean, and we were making some really good progress on starting to, obviously it's a big ship that we got to turn directions on nationally when it comes to the national debt and spending problems. And, you know, we're facing a situation where now nearing 20 $8 trillion of national debt, and the President Trump had put together a framework for at least starting to make the directional turn and putting some limits in place. And it seems like all bets are off now. And now it is back to the land of make-believe on budgeting and spending, unfortunately, and lots of huge spending proposals, obviously, getting thrown around in terms of things with this new president, and lots of things still to be determined what Congress has the appetite for. But unfortunately, Mark, as you know, lots of times it's the opening bid from the president, and then Congress is going to add their own spending on top of that. And of course, taxpayers even get a worse deal.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Trump was willing to borrow last year, especially during the COVID times there, because interest rates were near zero. And his thought was, you know, we needed to prop up the economy. I think most people were okay with that side of things, as long as it was going to real people and real businesses hurt by government actions, you know, no fault of their own. But of course, that's not what happened. The Democrats wanted to pay off public debt incurred by the states and all sorts of other spending. It was just ballooning that beyond all reason. And now that borrow our way to prosperity mindset really seems to have taken hold with no thought at all to deficits or debt. I mean, is this really the new monetary policy that we're going to borrow and print money with no thought of ever paying it back?
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of folks up here on Capitol Hill that are completely fine with that mentality. And, you know, whether it's throwing $400 billion more towards kind of the, as you mentioned, the irresponsible states that have borrowed and taxed and spent way too much for decades, not related to COVID, or, you know, adding all kinds of other new spending. We're heading in the wrong direction when it comes to adding to the national debt. And that's something that both parties can share some blame on in years past. But I think the differentiation that you pointed out is exactly right, which is I think most Americans were fine with if government came in and basically had takings and forced businesses to shut down and ruined people's livelihoods for a period of time in order to try to keep people, you know, safe or navigate the pandemic. I think most Americans thought that some temporary relief for those businesses, such as PPP and other things that were done, may have been a reasonable use of dollars. But apart from that, things that those were never letting a good crisis go to waste, unfortunately, in terms of Rahm Emanuel or Saul Alinsky's philosophy, wanted to add on every other program on top of that. And that's where I think most people had the rub.
Well, you know, it just seems like this notion, and I've heard it from other sources as well, that Biden is just planning on spending. I mean, if you're looking at spending $100 trillion on the Green New Deal alone, I mean, that's going to completely blow up these debts. I mean, it just seems nowadays like any normal economic rules are just being completely thrown out the window. And as far as recovering from COVID and whatnot, do we have really a true sense of the damage done to the economy? I mean, can we really literally just turn the switch back on and everything's fine?
Well, unfortunately, no. I think that unfortunately, a lot of the pain that was caused throughout the last year is going to be permanent. In the case of a lot of the small businesses, those NFIB type members across the United States that are shut down for good in many cases. And those are just the horror stories that came out of this because of the government shutdowns, because of a lack of liability protection, let's say, or other things that kept them on the sidelines and then eventually forced shutdowns. That's going to be gone for good in many cases. Now, on the other hand, I think it's important to note is, you know, the states that managed things, I think, most effectively and mitigated risks and tried to balance out risks and public health and shutdowns, like Florida and other states, you know, those states have relatively bounced back well compared to the New Yorks and the New Jerseys and the Californias and the Illinois, you know, out there that have basically taken a much different approach. And now guess who's asking for a federal bailout, right? It's the states that had the most aggressive lockdowns and have not done anything but just double down on the tax and spend approach on top of the lockdown approach.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening here in Oregon. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about the comparison between the states in a later segment. But looking ahead, you know, actually, my producer is saying we ought to cut early here. So, all right, everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Jonathan Williams talking about the crazy world ahead. Stay with us. Economics right now with Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. They also put out their yearly Rich States, Poor States guide that looks at the competitiveness among the states. We'll be talking about that some in the next segment. But Jonathan, We're talking in that last segment, really, about just the crazy economics that's been going on. And one of the things that has really come out, there's been a lot of buzz this week about GameStop shares. And essentially what happened here, for people that aren't aware, you had some internet users in a Reddit channel found out about some big hedge funds that were short selling GameStop. And they were essentially betting against the future outlook. That's what, you know, short selling is. The Reddit users started buying up the shares, which massively drove up the share price, which then squeezed the short sellers, forcing them to eat a $39 billion loss. I mean, that's astonishing, $39 billion. This is really being hailed as David's against Goliath's. And from one angle, it kind of is that. But now all of these Davids have got billions of overvalued stock, and they could end up losing a lot of money if the value, if the underlying value is not there. So again, it's like the normal rules don't apply and we just don't care. I think there's some interesting aspects to this, though. One, on both sides of the political aisle are cheering this. On the right, it's being hailed as an attack on the establishment, the big money oligarchy, and so on. On the left, it's an attack on billionaires, and that's always cool when the rich lose money. But second, we saw the intervention of big tech, which stepped in to protect themselves, and Big Wall Street, and they shut off trading of GameStop via the Robinhood app, TD Ameritrade, and some others. Big tech was inserting itself rather than the market or government shutting down the trading. I mean, they're just out there closing off these apps, preventing people from trading. That would be really alarming if big tech is now deciding who trades and what. Are you concerned about that?
Well, yeah, we're going to know a lot more, obviously, of the details as we go forward and what actually happened and not. But if true, that is pretty disturbing. I mean, that would be seem to be somewhat of a price manipulation if these platforms are weighing in and allowing selling but not buying, let's say. That's going to be something that's going to be a big topic, I'm sure, for financial regulators and policymakers going forward.
Sure.
But I think the overall point, though, is a good one in that, yes, it's easy to kind of knock hedge funds and Wall Street, and you know, there is a lot of risk involved with short selling. There's no doubt about it. That's why the hedge fund folks get paid, you know, big money to take, you know, that kind of a risk and sometimes navigate it very well. But on the other side of the issue is, you know, who is hurt by that? It's not, mm-hmm. you know, some business necessarily or a rich fat cat in Wall Street that's hurt by that. In many cases, it may be even, let's say, teacher pension funds that wisely or unwisely have used hedge funds to manage their portfolios and manage people's retirements. And so it's not a victimless situation here that it's, you know, crowdsourcing, ganging up on, you know, the fat cats on Wall Street. It's always kind of, you have to look a layer deeper than that to say who actually is being hurt when there's a huge loss, let's say, in the case of this. So let's not celebrate market losses for anybody, I think is the safe thing to say here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not a fan of short selling. I think it tends to be very predatory. It just boggles my mind, though, that Americans are celebrating when companies have been caught. I mean, that we're celebrating when companies are losing billions of dollars. I mean, you know, those billions of dollars would then have been normally used to reinvest in other companies. I just think that this is horrible. That's what we're doing, is we're celebrating it when somebody loses all this money. But on the other side of that, are you concerned about the long term damage these types of crowdfunding and internet fueled interventions could do? And conversely, do we really need to worry about this?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a silver bullet answer for that one, but it's if we see more of these examples pop up, I know it's going to draw the attention, like I said, of the regulators and policymakers to see, you know, is there something awry? And I'm sure there will be some. Now, I don't know if I'd agree with them or not, but, you know, there will be some that always look for a government regulation answer to this. On the other hand, there seems to clearly be some manipulation perhaps going on in a case like this once we know a little bit more of the details.
Well, I just am curious how this is going to play out in the end here when you've got all of these Reddit users snapping up overvalued shares, and then they're going to be sorry when you know the value just isn't there to support that share price. So getting back to Washington, D.C. there and some of the craziness that's coming out of there, Biden is up to something like 38 or 39 executive orders in his first week of office, about 10 times what Trump had in his first week. And a lot of Biden's executive orders have been to pause, stop, or reverse things that Trump had done to make the economy do so well under him. Among them was rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, pausing new oil and gas leasing on public lands, reopening the floodgates to illegal immigration. I mean, a lot of this is going to have, I think, very negative effects on the economy. Are there any executive orders that jump out and as an economist, just make you want to groan?
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the big ones. Obviously, then there's Keystone XL decision, which costs, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands of good paying, in many cases, union jobs across the United States, and certainly IRC's one of our greatest allies in Canada that's gone as a partnership on that project. But one that flew under the radar a little bit is the decision, and this was written about my former OMB director and chief of staff to President Trump, Mick Mulvaney, the other day in the Wall Street Journal, and he pointed out that there was a decision within OMB on deregulation that had been such a huge success of the Trump administration in terms of keeping America moving on the economy and fueling a lot of the economic growth. But something as simple, let's say, for as economists as myself, talking through cost versus benefit. Why is it that we need to look at costs and benefits of regulation? It looks like the Biden administration has taken steps to kind of take go back on that in terms of the Trump administration's efforts on really measuring the actual costs and benefits of proposed regulation and coordinating that through the Office of Management and Budget. That seems to have gone by the wayside. Once again, something not really on the headline news at night, but something very important over time to not only the American economy, but to many people's livelihoods across the country.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting that my producer pointed out is that we're not in an Obama-Biden world anymore. We're in a Trump world, and people really got used to making money and keeping it under a Trump administration. It's going to be very interesting to see how all of that plays out under the Biden administration. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Jonathan Williams, and coming up, we'll be talking about the state of the states. Final segment now, Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find out more about them by heading to ALEC, that's ALEC.org. And you can also head to richstatespoorstates.org that we're going to be talking about in this segment. But, you know, before we leave that, the executive orders and stuff, when you just look at the entirety of what he was doing, it's weakening America and making other countries stronger again. And I just look at that, and especially around like the Keystone XL pipeline, cutting back on the leases on the oil and gas leases on public lands and all the rest. Why would anyone want to weaken America's energy independence? That makes no sense to me.
Well, and especially just since we had gotten to independence just recently, right, when we had stopped importing from Saudi Arabia and other places, you know, and you look at the idea of the leases with oil and gas, one element that's not talked about in that area enough is how much that's going to hurt states as well, since states share in the revenue. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal just recently talking up that element. And guess what? What big government takes away on one hand, it's going to give in another hand in the bailout of states. So if you're beholden enough to big government and you kind of hang with them long enough, you'll get your bailout, I guess.
I guess, yeah. I thought it was ironically funny that New Mexico, which voted overwhelmingly for Joe Biden, they're all up in arms that he has now turned around and canceled all of these oil and gas leases. And they've said that this is going to tremendously hurt New Mexico. Well, guess what? I guess you got what you voted for. So in terms of the taxes that are coming out, could you go over some of those? I know that there's a whole bunch of them in terms of changes to tax laws and whatnot that are either being hinted at or openly talked about. I mean, are there any in particular that really have you concerned?
Well, there's a lot, right? Because it depends on if you listen to which rhetoric, I guess, you listen to on taxes, and which, you know, President Biden are we going to get? Is it going to be the President Biden that said, you know, during part of the campaign that I will repeal every piece of the Trump tax reform package, which would be obviously hugely damaging across the economy with the business tax rates, the individual rates, the standard deduction, the child care tax credits, or do they keep some of the more popular elements of that and start phasing down based on, let's say, an income level of $400,000 a year, or you pick the level that it may be. I think there's a lot of more. There's really more questions than there are answers in terms of what taxes may, tax cuts may get repealed from the Trump era. You know, one of the other things that's being talked about quite a bit now, though, is how do you pay for infrastructure? We all hear that the infrastructure package is going to perhaps be next on the agenda in February. Is that paid for through increased federal gas tax? Is that paid for through a carbon tax, perhaps? We you're hearing rumors of, which would obviously be unprecedented in the course of U.S. Tax policy at the federal level. We've seen some of the damaging effects when those policies were talked about at the state level. Oregon, Washington, California, no stranger to those discussions. But those are a lot of things on the table. And I think it just remains to be seen how aggressive and how much of the progressive side of the Democrat Party does Joe Biden gravitate towards now.
Mm, yeah. Well, as we said, you have a site, richstatespoorstates.org, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. I know that your release is still forthcoming for this year, looking at the competitiveness between the states. But one of the things that we have always loved when we talk to you is that in these 50 test tubes of democracy, it might be doom and gloom where you're at, but there are always some brighter spots out there. And you had mentioned during the segments there that West Virginia now has a supermajority. Talk to us about what's going on there.
Well, really exciting times. And in my 15 years of watching state policy, I actually think that West Virginia legislature, Governor Justice, who was a Democrat, changed parties to be Republican in the mm-hmm. last couple of years. Mm-hmm. They have a shot to be the first state in 40 years to repeal their state personal income tax. Alaska mm-hmm. was the only other state to do it. They realize they need to reverse the loss of population. West Virginia is actually going to lose a congressional seat, one of their three, after the 2020 census is finalized and they redraw the U.S. House district. And so there's a real desire to say, how do we make West Virginia more attractive to businesses and families and make it a great quality of life at a lower cost of life? And it's a really fun thing to watch. I just was talking with legislators about that, and I think they're heading in exactly the right way to make West Virginia a more prosperous state.
Well, in terms of the economic outlook for a lot of these states that you look at there in rich states, poor states, do you have any surprises you're thinking this year?
Well, you know, there's a lot of states that have weathered this storm relatively well in terms of the COVID pandemic and economic shutdowns because they took a much more measured approach. You know, there are states that have unemployment rates in the 3 or 4% range, Iowa, Nebraska, Utah, states that have handled things relatively well and had good governors and good legislators in place, that they're going to be on the offense and cutting taxes this year and looking to make themselves more competitive, where I think then you have the other side where New Jersey still has a double-digit unemployment. New York, California, Illinois, close behind. I mean, there are going to be a lot of debates over tax increases. So once again, 50 laboratories of democracy, we're going to see states moving in every which direction. But I do think that we're going to be very pleasantly surprised this year that many, many states are going to be on the offense in terms of cutting tax rates, giving taxpayers back more of their hard-earned money, and let's hope giving some relief to these small businesses that have been on the ropes now for 9 or 10 months.
Yes, absolutely. Wouldn't that be fantastic to see? Unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Jonathan, we want to thank you so much for your time today.
Always great to join you, my friend.
We really just scratched the surface of Joe Biden's executive orders, which seem all about ending what made America strong under President Trump. You know, if China had put an honest-to-goodness actual agent of the Chinese Communist Party in the Oval Office, how would it look any different than what we have now? Especially after watching President Xi take his victory lap at a speech at the Great Reset Conference in Davos. You know, there are a lot of punishing taxes coming our way. We'll have Jonathan back on to talk about those. In the meantime, check out the links on today's show page. Please subscribe to our podcast. That helps us grow and help us spread the word. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.